I'm Wem.
And I'm Lewis.
This is the Forest School Podcast.
Let's go!
Do I want to talk about what?
I was going to say, do you want to talk about your cats
and
dogs?
I do want to talk about my cats and dogs theory. Because...
Do you want to start with that?
I tested it out as a metaphor the other day. I was thinking about how I think you could group a lot of educational ideas and a lot of like pedagogy into cat education or dog education. And what I mean by that is the way in which I look at these are loads of sweeping statements in this metaphor, obviously. But I was thinking about the way in which people normally interact with those animals. And I was thinking about the differences about the way you would proffer activities to a dog in terms of like just absolutely if you were going out and going for a walk or something. I say this as someone who's never had a dog, but you know, you sort of amp it up. We're in a pack. We're doing this together. One person's taking the lead. There are definite rewards and sanctions and like coercion and hierarchies and leader of the pack and all these things. Okay.
Although if you listen to like modern dog behaviorists, they're like, actually that kind of like alpha male leader of the pack thing is
not correct.
It's outdated. But I know what you're saying. This kind of like dopamine driven kind of like, do the thing.
Yeah, happy kind, waggy tail.
You know, kind of high energy. Like you do the thing and then you get a reward for it. And then you do, what's the next thing? Tell me what to do next.
And I think sometimes that is... Yeah. Subconsciously how people imagine the participants in their, I think it tends to be a more short-term provision, is how people view like the session should go. Like a forest school session should be like, we do this and then it's great and then we get that thing and then it's great and then we go on another, we go for a walk and then it's great and we do. And then I was thinking about, okay, so what's the other bit of that then? Is the other bit cat education, where you gently put out your hand and almost ignore them and go, look, this is just here. If you want to sniff my hand and see if I'm a safe person, that's fine. And maybe I got you an activity, but if you want to just sleep in the box, then hey, we're just happy that you slept in the box. And like the expectations and the energy that you come to that situation with is so different. And we did have someone start recently, a volunteer start with us. And I was trying to sum up that whole experience that we've talked about loads on the podcast of like amping up like an offer in a dog style of like, guys, does anyone want to? And then I reckon we could. And they're like, no. The cat response of like, no. And I was trying to.
Do you think what you're describing is different to the low arousal approach? Or do you think it's the same thing?
I think it's different because you can tell me if you understand things differently. So my understanding is that part of the low arousal approach can be removing decision making from the process. And in some ways, you can be high energy, low arousal, because in that first scenario, it is in some ways low arousal because you are holding the reins of like, I trust that the leader will show me what happens next. I trust that we'll be taken to the next place. You're not making lots of decisions. And in the same way that in air quotes, cat style could be seen as high arousal because you're putting lots of the decision making onto the participant. So I think it's more about vibes and energy than necessarily neatly fitting into the low arousal thing. Hey, podcast listeners, if you are enjoying the show, there's a small but very powerful thing you can do to support us, and it's completely free. If you can take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast, it means the world to us in terms of sharing all the wonky goodness that we're getting up to with more and more people. Thank you so much to everybody that's already left reviews. We do read them and try and reply to people if we can. Sharing it and getting the word out to more people really helps what we're doing. Thank you all so much.
Okay, so then it sounds to me like we talk so much about demands, don't we? That it's very closely linked to that. That that and in the same way that cats can kind of smell it.
Oh yeah, they know. Like, they know the one. If you're the one that bends down and goes puss, 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 and then they go to the person that wants them to go.
Yeah, that is just chill and like not giving eye contact. Yeah, very still and calm and like literally don't care. Yeah. Like literally don't care. And that, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not to say that one style
is better or worse than the other, I don't think.
Like some groups and some sessions, like, and even with the same group over the course of a day, for example. So there might be a time where that kind of like dog style thing is needed, isn't there? Like you and I will both do it sometimes in terms of like, right, everyone's at really low ebb now. We need to move around, or we need to, like, I need to scoop some people up and like carry them with me because I've given them the opportunity to kind of make their own choices and do some stuff, and they're really floundering, and then that's not working for them right now, so they need me to kind of be the ship that carries them along and to get a win. You know, we talk about that, don't we, in terms of like dopamine, like I did a thing and it blooming worked, and like I've got that dopamine now. So that's not to say that kind of dog style, if you want to put it
let's refer to dodge. Let's be more cutesy about it, let's call it like doggy style. That's
oh no, oh my god. Arr! Yeah, certainly I think it comes with trust as well, doesn't it, with people kind of letting their guard down and being their own real self and not masking and not trying to please you and just being like, yeah, I'm just gonna see what today throws up. That once you get to that stage, it's kind of cringy sometimes to be that like, come on everyone, we're gonna do the thing and
disingenuous
feel the benefits, like, yeah. And people are like really at home and genuinely not afraid to show you or tell you what they think, and also they feel ownership over the space and the community, that they don't need that, so they're kind of looking at you going,
that's what I mean in terms of, I think, like, it's more common in short-term programs or shorter term programs, because one, you as a leader can uphold that energy way longer, but also the recipients can be in that paradigm, that hierarchy, paradigm, relationship, whatever you want to refer to it. But what I thought was useful about this metaphor was, quite often you and I will say, oh, there's another one that we're going to do maybe a whole episode on that we were talking about the other day, but I won't give that away yet. We're saying, like, sometimes it's useful to have metaphors to sum up all of this waffle, in that we can just very quickly go to each other, this needs a bit of big dog energy, doesn't it? Yes, okay, let's go do big dog. Or like saying to a new person, like, hey, just so you know, these guys are real cat based, so like you can put the activity out, let them sniff it, but please don't have an ego attached to it where if they don't pick it up, you know, like, it just helps you to get rid of the waffle, and in a way that's understood very quickly go, I've got it, I know how to interact in this scenario. And I like little bits like that,
the magic of metaphors. Can I just I saw a quote which is in some ways very basic, but in other words succinctly sums up some of this stuff, which is, there's a world of difference between insisting on something, someone's doing something, and establishing an atmosphere in which that person can grow into wanting to do it. So I was chatting with somebody about kind of play-based education this week, and then this quote appeared in front of my eyes, and I was like, that is kind of it in a nutshell, in terms of, like, you just create an atmosphere where somebody might decide that they want to do things.
Like,
that's forest school, do you know what I mean? Like, we're not going to insist that you do anything, but we're going to create a place where you might start having
this is to say,
that would be cool,
this is the approach that we are cultivating, because I think we need to remember that there are forest schools that run in a very, like, that, you know, dog-based energy, very, and there are things you have to do more or less at different forest schools. And so we're talking about, like, the ethos that we are cultivating.
And this is exactly the conversation I had with this person this week. It's like, doesn't mean it's better. It's just our kind of play-based, intrinsically motivated kind of vibe. But anyway, yeah, thanks for the cat and dog metaphor. I think there's more to be said.
I think as it develops and percolates now in practice,
yes,
I will be able to go, it's not that, it's actually lemurs and giraffes. Now hear me out, it will be like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But you had a different topic.
Yeah, or like, not just cats, ginger cats versus tabby cats.
I've got a tortoiseshell cat stuff. Who... Oh my God. I mean, there's a thing that says that tortoiseshell cats, because they are... There's something about their DNA, their genetic code is both... They're trying to be a brown cat and a ginger cat at the same time, and that they are apparently quite schizophrenic as a cat, and that 100% makes sense with my tortoiseshell cat. She wants to be a lab cat so much, but also she's basically got PDA. She can't let you be, you know, she can't let herself be a lab cat because that would mean giving in.
Yeah. I saw a thing that said, it was a photo of a beautiful ginger kitten and people going, help me, like, he just, like, bites us all the time. Like, I don't know about cats. Like, can you guys, like, help me? People went, you bought a ginger cat? What did you expect? Like, just person after person after person going, yeah, this is my psychopathic ginger cat. Although I have a ginger cat who is lovely and very soppy. So, yeah, you know, exception proves the rule and all that. But yes, I have another topic. And the topic is, I'm going to read the name of the article. We're doing a academic-y article-y one today. This article is called Disconnected, What Can We Learn from Individuals with Very Low Nature Connection by Alexia Barabol and David Booth, and published 30th of June 2022. So if you want to read the full article, you can probably
We'll stick it in that. The links.
The article belongs to the special issue, The Impact of Built Natural, Social and Virtual Environments on Human Health. So I was also looking back through previous podcast episodes because this article is all about a study which we have already talked about. And let me find it.
We did an episode a long time ago, didn't we?
We talked about this.
Nature connection.
Yeah, it was February 2021.
And it was about how you measure nature connection, what the parameters are, and what does that actually mean if you try and boil it down in academic terms? If you're enjoying the Forest School podcast, we wanted to let you know about the ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content that you can get by joining us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/childrenoftheforest today and become a Patreon, you get ad-free episodes of the regular podcast plus bonus things. Plus, when we have guests coming on, we try and get a little bit of a heads up and shout out there so that our Patreon supporters can ask us any questions that they want of those guests before the interview takes place. So head to patreon.com/childrenoftheforest. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, and it was based, so the if you want to listen to that previous episode, it's called What Best Explains Children's Connection with Nature by Miles Richardson. And he was basically looking at the MENE study, which was conducted in England. And it was basically, measuring people's nature connection and trying to find what it was that sort of increased nature connection, that kind of thing. So it's this big study. So this article that we're talking about today is also using that same study that was conducted, I think, from 2009 to 2019, which is interesting because it's obviously pre-pandemic. But this article, rather than looking at, you know, what is nature connection and what are the factors that make people nature connected, this article was the writers were interested in this MENE study and how there wasn't that much focus on the other end of the spectrum. So what causes people to have low nature connection and what similarities might there be within that population? And they're basically arguing in this article that more research needs to be done. And I have to say, I was kind of convinced by the end of the article. I was like, yes, you are right. I agree with this. Did you feel the same?
Yes, I did. I think there's some interesting stuff in here, especially in the start where they're talking about a lot of those other studies and saying that there's biophilia as a term. The biophilia hypothesis proposes the term biophilia to describe. And then they were talking about biophobia, which I'd never heard of that before.
That makes sense.
An interesting term to have in your Rolodex to describe a thing that's going on.
Yeah.
We've
So can we just clarify that just real quick, just to interrupt? So the biophilia being the like innate human need to feel close to the natural world. So it's this theory that we are born with this like deep connection and that we need to feel close to it. And obviously biophobia being the opposite of that, which might include, for example, this theory of humans having an innate fear of snakes, for example. So being born with this kind of actual genuine phobia of some parts of the natural world, but then also there's stuff that goes beyond the stuff you're born with. There might be
Actually really like to, possibly it's an episode on its own, but read this book, The Biophilia Hypothesis. I think there could be a lot in there, because we talk a lot about different divergences across the human population and how like there's lots of talk in different ways where people go, well, that's actually would have made you really good in X scenario, or, you know, where that now is quite challenging, that would have made you, you know, beneficial.
Do you mean sort of going beyond pathologizing brain differences and going into like, actually that's really useful?
Yeah. And that, a lot of times going back sort of anthropologically and going like, yes, the society now as it's set up doesn't value that thing, but if you were wired in exactly the same way 2000 years ago, you would have been useful for XYZ jobs. And so there's also something in there, I think, about biophobia being not just a natural thing of like, hey, snakes are everywhere, and so that's a useful biophobia, but also there being like, well, there would have been a proportion of the population that were wired to have a higher than average biophobia, and they would have acted in a like potentially a really interesting way of keeping the more biophilia, the risk taking parts of the groups in check. So I think there's something really in there, like not saying biophobia is like negative, that it's not a thing that's like, you're broken if you have biophobia, or that if you're not in that nature connected end. Because one of the things that was in there was about the distribution of the nature connected population, and saying that it is skews very high at the top end. Like there are, as I read it, and you tell me if I've read this wrong, it was saying there's a proportion at the end who are so extremely nature connected that they're right up there and in terms of that bell curve, it's shoved right over to the right, and then it drops off very sharply and has a very very long tail. So there's like some very nature connected individuals who are dragging the average up, but the tail on that data is very low. It's hard to do a visual description of things on a podcast, but hopefully I've done a half decent job there. But saying that in terms of population spread, most people are in that tail. It's only the extreme people on the end who are bringing that average up, because you know, that's what those biophilia people do. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we wanted to let you know that we want to hear from you, the Forest School community. If you've got questions, topics you'd like to explore, books you want us to review, share your ideas and thoughts with us by emailing childrenoftheforest@outlook.com. Your input is what fuels our episodes, and we can't wait to connect with you.
Quite a lot of maths and statistics and symbols in this article there to get your head around, which I was just like, oh, okay, like, ooh, academic brain, try and get that working. But to kind of summarise the findings of the article in terms of the kind of patterns amongst people with nature disconnection, they found that most people who were at the lower end of nature connection were between 16 to 24 years old, were male, were single, and a higher proportion were renting from local authority and not employed. So those were the things that they found that had a significant correlation. And when they got to the parts of the survey that were to do with kind of well-being, these people who sort of scored low on the nature connection scale also scored low in life satisfaction questions, and also low in the pro-environmental behaviours section. So they had low nature connection, low levels of life satisfaction, and low levels of pro-environmental behaviours. And there was a correlation between low psychological well-being, but not any correlation between physical well-being.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So they couldn't find a link there, which is interesting, isn't it, to think that you might imagine that if somebody is feeling like they don't have great physical well-being, that that would have an impact on their nature connection in terms of their mobility or being able to get outside easily and those kind of things. But that's not the case. And also, I thought this interesting point, and again, you tell me if I've read this wrongly, but the article says that they found that there was a correlation between lower socioeconomic groups and lower nature connection. However, when they looked at the regression model, no significant predictors were there. So I took that to mean once they had worked out all of the variables, used the certain equation, gone, actually, hang on a minute, if we look at the data in this way, then actually there isn't a correlation there.
That's how I read it. I actually got really stuck and had to Google, like, use some stuff to try and pick out a sentence, because so this is done through a survey, and there were some of the questions were like scale 1 to 10. Some of the questions were binary, yes, no. And the pro-environmental behaviours were done, yes, no. And then in summarising it, they said, the third and final question we had to investigate was whether nature disconnection was associated with pro-environmental behaviours. Right? I understand that. If you are not nature connected, do you still do environmental things?
And the example questions were things like, do you recycle recyclable items, and do you buy environmentally friendly products?
And then it said, in this instance, we observed that pro-environmental behaviours, as measured by an aggregate set of questions, were negatively correlated with nature disconnection. So I had to unpick that. And as I read it, negatively correlated means the more nature disconnected you are, the more pro-environmental behaviours you do.
I read it as being the opposite, but I don't
know. I would imagine that that would be correlated.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Wait, I need to unpick this now. It's like a double negative term.
Yeah, it is. I know. But the lower, going back to the lower socioeconomic status thing.
Sorry, I've read that wrong.
That would fit with
less environmental behaviours, less nature connected. Yeah. I've just done all the double negatives in my head. I apologise, everybody that had to come on that journey with me.
Yeah, yeah. You've, you've untied that knot. But the lower socioeconomic group connection thing would fit with when we talked about the Natural England survey originally a few years ago. That was a key finding from that, wasn't it? That actually you might imagine that people as part of a higher socioeconomic group might have higher nature connection because they are, you know, potentially being carted around to all these different places and traveling and maybe having more time with their parents kind of outdoors and all that kind of stuff. But actually that was found to not be the case, and that people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds still could have very high nature connection. And it wasn't about the variety of places you went to or the like stunning scenery. It was about connection maybe to like just a bit of grass outside your block of flats or whatever. And that was a really interesting finding. So that fits with this study, that actually it's not, you know, it might on the surface value look like it is correlated, but it isn't necessarily. But this thing about like the young male, single, not employed thing. So they answered the sort of, they put this question in the survey, I feel part of nature, you know, yes or no on a scale of 1 to 10. So this group answered in a very low number for that question. So that's sort of how they tried to measure nature connection, and so that's and then they're kind of looking at this article about why that might be, and I found this really interesting. So they sort of say in the article, we might at first of all think this might be due to lack of experience, that these people haven't had or don't currently have the ability or the access to positive nature experiences and time outdoors. But this article is saying maybe it's that, but also what about maybe it's to do with past negative experiences or disordered experiences, you know, and how if we could dig deeper into that and find some research, because it's almost like a vicious circle, chicken and egg sort of thing, isn't it? Because you've got this like, identifiable low nature connection and low life satisfaction, and which comes first? You know, it's like a, so if we're saying that nature connection kind of enhances, and I have to Google this word, right? Eudaimonic mm-hmm. well-being. Yeah. Did you see that? Living a life in of virtue in pursuit of human excellence. So things like integrity and resilience and autonomy and wisdom and gratitude and self-compassion. So the article, the sort of first study makes this link between high nature connection and high eudaimonic well-being. So the theory might be that the more nature connected we are, the more we feel psychologically good mm-hmm. in this realm, you know, and that's certainly something that's connected to Forest School, isn't it? That's part of our kind of ethos about, you know, facilitating that kind of well-being and self actualization and all that kind of stuff. So if nature connection is tied up with that eudaimonic well-being, if low nature connection in some groups of people, like these young men, for example, isn't just based on lack of opportunity, it's actually based on like a negative childhood experience, or because they do sort of mention that about childhood.
Yeah, it's something like 90% more effective before the age of 9 or something, and then they talked about the drop in adolescence that again we covered again, and so it's just interesting knowing how pivotal those points of contact are with nature, because your intervention in air quotes for nature connection is going to become less effective at certain points, which is really interesting. Hey, lovely Forest School people. I know, people listening to this, you are bored of doing damper bread. You are bored of doing marshmallows. You're probably bored of doing hot chocolate. So I wanted to let you know about the book Forest School Cooking that I've written. It is half recipes that are going to take you away from the boring marshmallows and damper bread that are driving you mad, and into like cool meals and things on sticks and fast things and slow things. And the other half of the book is all about different ovens and stoves and things that you can build to cook in different ways. I know we personally have had it where you realize that what we're doing this week, oh, we're frying something on the frying pan. What we're going to do next week, we're going to fry something in the frying pan. So building up loads of different ovens like rocket stoves and pizza ovens, it's all in the book, and it helps you to grow your cooking from something that the kids are just waiting to get the sugar into them to something that they're actually enjoying and getting a bit more out of that cooking. So you can find your copies on Amazon of Forest School Cooking and take your cooking to the next level today.
Yeah, and it's sort of saying as well about, if it's not just a lack of positive experience in nature, if it is like maybe due to a negative experience or disordered experiences or aversions, is there also something maybe there about it being they call it a cultural artifact, and being kind of symbolic of like being disenfranchised and separated from society in general? So yes, you're separated from nature, but you're also, it's sort of all tied up with how you're actually disconnected, not just from nature, but from society. Which, you know, you could imagine might be the case if you're like living in really insecure housing, you don't have a job, you don't have a relationship with a significant other at this current time, you're at that really difficult point of, you know, age 16 to 24. I don't know about you, but blimmin' hell, it's probably the hardest time of my life in terms of easily. Like, what am I doing now? All the anchors have gone, you know, you're like, well, you've been through all the compulsory education. You have to make some decisions now, and you need some backup. You need some financial backup. You need family backup. You need people around you to help you out, because it's the time where if you don't have that, it's very, very difficult to make it on your own. So that kind of figures, and they were sort of talking about separation and alienation potentially at that time of life.
I want to go back a little bit, though, if I can, because I wanted to just talk about that thing that arguably nature disconnection may be a byproduct of disordered experience, negative, fearful, uncomfortable or adversive encounters. And so that's definitely something that is really interesting to me, because, again, as part of that journey, I think there was a period of time where I was like, Forest School is the panacea. This is the one. Everybody needs this. You know, just fresh out of training or fresh out of being a teacher, and this world was like, oh my god, it's basically what I was saying was like, this is so much better for me, it must be better for you, and then share this revelation, and then you find things that
watch me put a slug on my face.
But you watch, you know, and then you, the echo chambers of the world reaffirm this, and you get brought more stuff and more stuff and more stuff. And definitely through this journey, I'm now way more in a place of like, this is the thing. Our forest school is the way that it is. This is a thing that we want to do. It is by no means perfect. I would almost go as far as saying it's not perfect for anybody, but it is pretty damn good for a certain subset of people or a certain subset of experiences. And that is all it needs to be. It doesn't need to be the like incredible one day experiences and incredible long term stuff and great for babies and great for, you know, like we can do all those things and we slightly tweak our offering. But I think we're in a place a lot more of going, this is what we'll do. This is the thing people we think is right for. It shifts as the group shifts. But this idea of nature disconnection being from disordered, negative, fearful, uncomfortable experiences, I think forest school is better placed than any other outdoor learning style. And obviously I'm biased, right? But I think we are better placed than a lot of outdoor ed in terms of the ethos of meeting people where they are and forest school morphing into a let me learn how you are comfortable in nature and let me facilitate that and we'll work that out and a lot more will come to you. Whereas I think a lot of these uncomfortable, aversive, fearful situations come from practices of this is where the outdoor practice is, sink or swim, this is where you meet us, you know, the walk is three hours long, or the site is over, you know, site's a bad example, but you know, the activities are these activities. If you don't like them for tactile reasons or because of how we're doing this or because it's dog energy or because it's cat, like those things are I would say way more instrumental. And so I think as forest school leaders we should be really amping that up in terms of our what we're advertising and what we are offering, particularly if you are offering things to schools and stuff. Is like it's very easy to get a bushcraft instructor in and they will be great and they will do their own thing, but if you have got groups with different needs or you've got groups with like social stuff that needs to go on, to be able to go forest school is the one that's going to go and meet them there and slowly go with them in order to avoid these uncomfortable, aversive, fearful experiences. I really think we're best placed for that. Audible is the best way I found of maximizing my time. I listen to it when I'm setting up for forest school sessions. I listen to it when I'm packing away forest school sessions. It's like getting that time back because you can be learning something at the same time. If you want to try Audible and you use the link that's in the podcast description, then we get a little bit of a kickback and it can really help to support the work that we do. So if Audible is something you want to try, head to the podcast descriptions and click on the link there to sign up today.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that having further research on that to try and find out, is there a correlation between adverse experiences when you're younger and then nature connection further on, and to try and find out a bit more about what those adverse experiences might be, because we might have some preconceptions about what those adverse experiences might be. Like, it might be like a sensory thing, but I imagine that there's actually quite a wide scope in terms of what negative experiences might be. Like, I remember you telling me about when you were a teacher and you weren't leading an outdoor session, you were taking your class to one and they ended up playing a ball game and the leader forcing them to go on one knee on the ground.
So it was one of those. It was one of those. I'll tell the story because it's very short. It was one of those scouting games where you stand in a circle and you throw the ball to each other, and if you drop it, then you go down on one knee, and then it's two knees if you drop it again, and then you sit down and you're out. And it was with a class and somebody who was an autistic child, and so. One of the challenges he had was physical coordination, also had sensory stuff, also had whatever else. And I had to eventually remove the child because the person leading the session was like, you know, he missed the ball. Obviously he missed the ball. That's not his skill set. It wasn't ever going to work. And the person was like, you need to go on one knee. and he couldn't do it, but he also couldn't have the words to do it. And so, and the person who was leading it took the ball, picked it up and said, no, no, we have to wait. You need to go down on one knee. And this 7-year-old knelt down and hovered his knee above the ground. And the leader was like, no, you need to go down. It was like muddy. It had been raining for like 4 hours. And it was like, no, you have to go on your knee. That's the game. We're not carrying on. And I should have done it sooner. But that was the point at which I just swept in and went, oh, me and him are going to, we're going to go somewhere else for a little bit. You carry on without us. But like, I mean, I should have been, if I was really trying to avoid that negative, I couldn't have avoided that negative experience for him, but I could have been quicker. And I don't know, that probably might not be a...
Yeah, well, you know what you know at the time. And also, like, you're not in charge of that session, are you? Like, they're leading it and you're like, but I just thought of that in terms of, you know, when I read about like adverse nature experiences, I might think about like interaction with either animals that have gone wrong or have not felt comfortable, or the environment, like mud or rain or wind or those kind of things, but also things that maybe we might not associate with nature connection, like playing a game, but it happens to be outside. You know, you're potentially developing that sort of experience and that trigger with, well, when I was outside with a group of people, this horrible thing happened to me. It was really unpleasant. Even if it's like a social experience, it doesn't have to be a, you know, a thing where I didn't like slugs and they made me touch a slug, or this animal surprised me and I wasn't ready. Or what, do you know what I mean? It can be, perhaps it could be experiences that are of a social nature, but they happen to be outside, and therefore your association is didn't enjoy that, not going back there.
Yeah.
I'd love to see
have more thoughts more about what we can do with this research, but I just need to pause. Very briefly, if that's all right. So my question is then, because I think we've picked this apart in reasonable detail now. So my question is, what could the forest school world, the forest school community, do with this information? What's the like takeaway that you go, okay, so we now understand, because these are like whys, you know, like why are people nature connected, or what causes those things? And then I guess the next question is like, where does that leave us? What does our provision come to?
Yes, well, you said earlier that you're thinking about like our forest call provision and saying you've kind of come to a place of acceptance of going, it's not perfect. It might not work for some people. It might not suit some people, and to kind of be at peace with that. And as you were saying that, I was going to sort of interject and say, yes. And also I think all the chats and reflections that you and I have about our groups are very, very often, if not always, based on how can we make this more accessible for people. And I don't just mean like physically accessible. How can we tweak what we deliver to make that person feel more safe, more at home, more able to self-actualize and attend? So, you know, whether that be for our home ed groups in terms of things that, you know, ways that we say things, or physical spaces that we create, or whether that be for our like parents and toddlers and thinking about, oh, that person, I don't know if they were okay. Like maybe they're struggling here. You know,
routines is a big one. Building stuff in regularly to go, that got really picked up well. Let's make that a consistent thing for the next 3 or 4 weeks, see how that goes. How does that feel?
Yes. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, we were kind of reflecting that the ways that we start sessions sometimes sort of seems to affect the mood of the rest of the session and how people connect with nature and with each other and all that sort of stuff. So if we all kind of accept that we're on a similar journey in the forest school community, that we're looking for what, like we believe in this ethos, or we believe in this approach, that if we are hopefully all on a similar journey about how do we make it accessible to people, then I mean, I always say there needs to be like more forest school specific research, and that probably means that I should like do some but like finding you want to, it's like you want to find out the people that you can't reach, the people that aren't coming or find it hard to come.
Okay, I want to jump on that last question.
Why is that? Like, what are the barriers? So,
because all those things. There's something in there which I think this study would have massively missed. Like, it just would have been really interesting as a final thing to set, to get the participants to be like, where on the graph would you, of like nature connectedness, would you ideally like to be? Because that is a massive piece of this puzzle that, again, like I was saying about like early when you come out of school and get into forest school or wherever I was, and it was like, this has helped me so much. We are reading this from a biophilia, nature connected, and call a spade, financially, we are also invested in getting people outside. There are all those like, what's the word I'm going for? I was going to say predecessors. That's not what I mean. You know, those things are stacked for us to assume that everybody wants to be at that end, or at least wants to be going that way. And I think there's an interesting puzzle piece here, which is like, do those participants think that nature connection is the way to get them to do
Well, I think they would probably say no, because you don't know what you don't know, do you? But the reason, like the previous study, found that there is a correlation between nature connection and eudaimonic well-being, that is an undeniable thing. So what you don't know is what is causation and what's correlation. So is it that people who are feeling great about life go out in nature and have a great time, or is it that people who go out in nature feel connected and feel eudaimonic well-being? So so you don't know. And I think they probably would say, well, no, because that's the point, isn't it? If your nature connection is low, then your interest is perhaps low as well. You know, you don't know what you don't know.
There's also something about, I think, just from my own little bubble of experiences, I would say that I probably see the least number of groups or the least amount of advertising in the forest school world aimed at young men, 16 to 24, who are single. Partly that is just, you know, we live in capitalist world and toddler groups are more profitable and consistent, and perhaps other demographics make better customers or make more consistent customers, or they align with that thing of like, who leads forest school sessions in terms of demographics, and then they go, well, I'll find more people like me because I know how to cater to them. And there are not many young male 16 to 24 year old people who are single in the forest school world, to my knowledge. That's an absolute reckon based on my experience, but
Well, you could just say underrepresented group. Yeah, and also like it's weird, isn't it, to go, what kind of activity would you design and market to be aimed at those, at that group? It's really interesting, because it's like, well, there's no precedent for it. It's almost like you kind of go, you sort of assume, well, those people are probably like catered for by, I was thinking about what experiences in the forest school or bushcrafty world that age group and that demographic would perhaps typically engage in. And what sprung to mind were kind of like bushcrafty stag parties. But then you might go, well, you know, this actually, we're talking about young men who are single. So maybe they don't, and they're not in that world of like, oh, well, I'm getting married and my friend's getting married, and so we're going to this like bushcraft stag do thing. So that doesn't connect with that group. And then just kind of making assumptions about, well, that with that age group and that gender, if they were interested in
that,
nature,
might be it as well, that it's not necessarily
it already,
seen as a hobby
already,
for that
or
demographic.
They're doing an apprenticeship, you know. It's Isn't that such a stupid preconception that we, you know, it's a societal construct, isn't it? It's like, well, you know, who goes and hangs out in the woods just for fun or and enjoyment and or relaxation and or learning, but on a kind of just intrinsic motivation level, rather than you're doing a, you know, college course in flora and fauna of some kind. But yeah, just you kind of assume, well, if those people were interested in it, they'd be doing like a, you know, qualification in countryside management or tree surgery or whatever. I don't need to design anything for them or invite them because they will be doing it already if they want to do it. And so, you know, and it's all that thing about feeling welcome because you see yourself represented. And if you don't see yourself represented, because you'd love to, but you don't have a kid to take with you, you know, the amount of young, we've got an increasing number actually of younger male parents attending our toddler groups. Have you noticed that? That over the kind of 8 years we've been doing it has steadily increased. I think it started to increase with the old, not older, but sort of post age 24 male parents start, you know, attending, and it is the age is dropping, I would say, which is brilliant. But they've got a kid, they've got a, the kid is the excuse to go, and then you go, and then actually your kid's having an all right time, but you're having an absolutely
I put a picture up the other day, didn't I, of that dad up a tree, you know, and I didn't write down, but his kid was maybe 30, 40 meters away playing in a treehouse. We had done this thing, set that up, and they were happily playing. And I just invited the dad and went like, do you want to come climb a tree? Because they were, there was a, sometimes there's that feeling of like, oh, I can only do it if my kid's doing it, which again is part of this, isn't it? It's like, I'm allowed to light a fire if I'm doing it with my 1 year old. I'm allowed to climb a tree. And I was, you know, quite often, things I say at toddler groups are, you know, you can do it as well. Or I just, you know, I go, oh, I'm nearly, you know, I'm 16 stone and I jump on all of this. So any big people want to have a go, you can absolutely have a go. Trying to engage that.
Yeah. I find that with like food and drink as well. It's like, you know, I've made these pancakes or these hot drinks or whatever, and I have to literally go, grown-ups too, like you are allowed to eat the food. You know, that's all part of like community building. It's like, oh, am I? Like, is that okay? But yeah, sort of, oh my God, I think this is such a rich vein for exploration. It's like, what is the offer? What is the invitation?
Well, can I offer a personal experience then as someone who has been a 16 to 24-year-old male, single male? Which is that like these things were saying, I think there is in that period of time for lots of young men, a period of like not feeling connected to society in general, being connected to your peers. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm, you know, I'm agreeing with that.
Which is what the
study says as well. And I think there is then, for at least me and people I knew, a heightened sense of like, look, I think there's a massive thing that's going on, which is that like we've commercialized more and more spaces, more and more social spaces, in a way that means that if you are not making purchases, you are not welcome in the centers of society. That like that is the way that things operate. You can't just hang out in shopping centers, any sort of street areas. Lots of communal spaces are now relegated to, but you have to buy drinks to sit in the coffee shop, which is not something that appeals to this demographic. Or then you have to drink, and then you have to be drinking alcohol. Okay, so that's where you congregate. They're all commercialized spaces, except for libraries. Libraries are the only place on a high street where you can go and not spend money, which is interesting. But I think there is also some,
or,
well, exactly.
It's like hanging out on the street or in the park, and then you're demonized.
Right.
Then it's like, oh, you're
but
a gang.
But even more so,
you're
as,
a bunch of,
as someone that grew up
like
semi-rurally, going out and socializing in any sort of like wild space, there was definitely an assumption that there was going to be destruction, or that there was going to be, you know, drinking and littering, or that there was going to be, that's where you're going so that you can have. Anyway, summarizing all of that is to say that like my experience of being in that age group was that the natural spaces were even more unwelcoming because there was an assumption of antisocial behavior implicit with people that would walk past, with anybody that would ask, you know, parents, where are you going? Oh, we're going to go meet up in there. You know, like that. So that's an interesting barrier, I think, to that age group, not just to the people who are in that age group accessing the provision, but also as a bias that people who own and maintain spaces to feel comfortable overcoming that prejudice in order to go we will bring that demographic in and I will show them the space that we have curated. Mm. So I don't necessarily think I have the answers. I'm just acknowledging that those things exist and those barriers are the ones we need to potentially look at.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because you might also, you might make assumptions about like the world of kind of the more like bushcrafty side of being outside is sort of stereotypically a very male world. But it's almost like that comes a bit later when you're a bit older. Like I can see people who are involved in like the scouting movement or similar groups like that have a kind of way in there. That's like a kind of a space to be in nature and in community.
Yeah.
But if you're not in that, then like you say, you know, where is your access and where is your, you know, I know forest school practitioners who run women's circles outside. I know forest school practitioners who run groups for teenage girls outside and the kind, you know, like Mimi, and she'll like make sort of crafts and candles and things with them. And there's that kind of like crafting focus, but trying to sort of pin down if you were going to offer it as a space for play, for example, for 16 to 24 year olds. There's a kind of association with just with like gaming, isn't there? With that age group. It's like, well, that's what young men do. Mm. They game.
Okay.
That's the kind of like societal currently like maybe view of like, if you imagined, if you said to somebody, imagine a boy or a man between 16 to 24 playing, what are they doing? I would imagine that most people would say gaming. And that's not necessarily true, but I think that's a societal you know, stereotype of that kind of age and their play. Whereas with teenage girls, you might get a bit more like, oh, they might be like, yeah, making things and crafting and chatting with each other and socializing and that kind of thing. But that obviously is very kind of short-sighted and narrow. It's such a narrow preconception of what that age group might enjoy doing that if we can somehow widen that perspective and widen the offer to participate, wouldn't it be a great experiment? Imagine you had all the money in the world and all the staff in the world, a million days in a week. You go, oh, I'm just going to chuck out loads of adverts locally for a session for young men aged this age to this age, and I'm going to make it like bushcraft themed. I'm also going to advertise this, and I'm going to make it like wide game themed. It's going to be like, come and play, blah blah blah, you know, and kind of pitch it in different ways. A bit like we used to do with our kind of holiday clubs when people didn't know what forest school was so much. So we used to go, this is cooking and crafts day. Actually,
it was forest school. And, craft day, and then there'd be a day that was like danger, knives and tools, blah, 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 and fire lighting. And that's exactly the same day. But
it's just forest school. Yeah. But what would grab people and what would make people feel welcome and make people feel like they were able to come?
It would be very, very interesting.
Great.
I'm interested to, I think we should keep looking into this. I'd be interested to find slightly more. I know this is only a couple of years old now, in 2024, but I would be interested to find if there's any more research into this, like low nature connection group. And also to hear from people listening, if you have been working with specifically these groups.
That's what I was going to say.
Please do like put stuff on our, we've got our Facebook group where we put all loads of different things like that, or you can like email us or just get in touch on either any of our social media stuff and just let us know and go, I've been working with this kind of group and here's what's worked and here's what, because if we're saying that there is a group that is underrepresented or underserved, then anything we can do to share that and share best practice there could be really massive. Before we go, we've had more people join our Patreon. Thank you so much for people that have joined our Patreon.
Yes.
It really, really does help. Helps to make our time feel like it's worth putting the books and stuff in and the time reading and prepping all the resources and editing and stuff. It really does help out just emotionally. It makes me feel like, oh, people like the thing. That's good. Yeah. Should keep doing the thing. So thank you to everybody that has either signed up on Spotify as a subscriber or has joined our Patreon. If you want to, you can go to patreon.com/children of the forest. And we have just, I think we are up to five guests in the chamber. And we always, mm-hmm. and the pipeline, and we always put
pipeline.
Up, when we've definitely booked a guest, we put up a little thing on our Patreon beforehand and say, you guys get first access. What questions do you want to ask? And people will say, oh, can you ask this? Or can you make sure to ask them about that? So if you enjoy our episodes where we're interviewing people and you think, oh, I've always got a really good question, I wish they'd talk about this thing, jump onto Patreon, sign up, and you can send us questions. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Yeah. Bye.
Yeah.
Bye.
Hey fellow Forest School leaders, we know that when you're out there leading your sessions, things can get a bit messy, and that's part of the beauty of it. But when it comes to your online presence and your branding, it's better to keep things neat and tidy. That's why we're introducing Fiverr, the one-stop destination for all your professional needs. You need a logo that reflects the spirit of your Forest School, a website that's inviting, as in your outdoor sessions, or maybe you're looking for someone to take care of all those nitty-gritty admin tasks, leaving you with more time to connect with nature and your students. At Fiverr, they've got a talented community of freelancers ready to bring your vision to life. Whether it's graphic design, web development, or any other skill you can imagine, their experts are there to make your Forest School branding stand out. Forest School can be messy, but your company branding shouldn't be. Head to Fiverr, that's FIVERR, theforestschoolpodcast.com to get started today.